podcast, Patrick Miner's podcast. Today's guest will discuss the very important issue of holistic medicine, a focus not simply on disease, but on the whole person. Our guest, Dr. Donald Starzynski, St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome, Don.
Thank you very much.
Don, introduce yourself.
I'm a doctor of neurology as a profession and have gotten very interested in holistic practices over the years. And really, that's my major focus now, teaching integrative medicine principles and doing some private practice also in that area.
Where did you get your medical training?
Most of my training has been at the University of Minnesota. I did my undergraduate work there and graduate work before medical school. And that's kind of important to mention because it was a very broad stroke as far as the type of interests that engendered social science in as an undergraduate and psychopharmacology in graduate school, which is the study of drugs and behavior, which then led me to my medical degree also at the University of Minnesota and subsequent training in neurology.
And your practice has been private practice exclusively in Minnesota?
My practice has been in Minnesota, but in private practice for only 8.5 years before I was asked to develop a rehab hospital in Minnesota. There was a call for treatment of individuals with traumatic brain injury that weren't being adequately served, and survivors and their families saw that there was a need for a specific specialized a hospital for treatment of people with traumatic brain injury. So I had the privilege of helping develop that hospital in central Minnesota called the Minnesota Neural Rehabilitation Hospital back in the mid-90s, and worked there for the last 20 years before doing more general consultative work through the state of Minnesota.
The brain injury you're referring to, is that typical of individuals suffering from a concussion?
Yes, and there's a whole spectrum of pathology that can result from a head injury or from another acquired brain injury, even if it's not from trauma, that can occur. Concussion is the milder end of the spectrum, but even that has degrees of severity, to the extent that a person may be very disabled as a result. And the type of individual that I was treating and have been treating over the years has a multitude of different neurologic problems, all the way from mild cognitive difficulties to behavioral problems, psychiatric problems, chronic pain, chemical dependency. And those are all very common issues that can occur after a person has a traumatic brain injury. And I think it's coming to light more and more, particularly with military and VA over the past few years, actually, compared to, you know, when we started back in the mid-90s. So there's a greater awareness of the importance of problems that people can have after any degree of brain injury. Very important to recognize and to treat properly.
Now, you're a scientist, and as such, when you're dealing with an issue like TBI, I'm assuming that over the years, you had enough observations and evidence that kept pushing you in new directions. Is that about right?
I think that's a good way of putting it. And if you look at rehabilitation medicine in general, it's a fairly broad stroke as far as people being treated with different modalities such as physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, neuropsychological treatments and such. So I was already seeing the importance of holistic practices in even more conventional medical practice, in specifically rehab medicine. But then, for an interesting reason, I guess, I became more and more interested in the Eastern approach and even more modalities and even more important aspects of treatment that can be utilized. And the way this really kind of started is I was looking for a new modality to use to treat my patients in the rehab hospital for their multiple neurologic problems. And I had the good fortune to be introduced to the possibility of using acupuncture as a modality for treatment. And I applied and fortunately won a Bush Medical Fellowship to study acupuncture in California. And that led me to further awareness of different horizons as far as how Eastern medicine treated an individual, not just with acupuncture, which is quite valuable and just one modality, but then I was introduced to herbal medicine, food as medicine, meditative practices, particularly Qigong, which is a meditative exercise. And at the same time, my children needed a sport. And as it turned out, my speech and language therapist was also an accomplished martial artist, in fact, 6-degree black belt in Chungdokwan Taekwondo. And so I thought, oh, good sport for the kids. And I did it with them and then was introduced again to this Eastern concept of, well, physical exercise is a great thing, but the concentration that you develop with martial arts and the meditative aspect of martial arts was as important to the physical training. So you can see that this broadened my interest in this integrative practice. It means just a blend of the best, an eclectic blend of the best practices that you can use. So I've, you know, again, over the years have realized that introduction of these modalities in my practice, in my rehab practice. And I've also done some work in the community giving lectures on these various subjects and teaching the meditative exercise practices and found great acceptance of such ideas and such treatment.
It seems like you're touching on the subject of cultural variations, which might go well beyond East and West.
It sure does. And in fact, even making that distinction between East and West can be blurred too. First of all, to say, and I think I mentioned it before, that if you look at a lot of the Eastern cultures and the way they view disease and treatment of disease, they have remarkable correspondences between how they look at the world and that their goal in practice of their healing is actually trying to achieve a balance in a person. So balance is the definition of health. And lack of balance is how disease starts. And so, and if you look across different cultures, they have their paradigms of medicine, of how they look at the environment, how they look at emotions, and the fact that a balance is a very necessary part of it. And interestingly, Western medicine isn't left out because there's outstanding aspects to Western medicine. I wouldn't practice medicine adequately if I didn't utilize the tools that I used in my study of Western medicine, including pharmacology. But think about before there were a lot of complicated drugs. Remember the Marcus Welby series? If you're old enough to remember the Marcus Welby series, it was a family practice doctor somewhere USA. And he was actually practicing more of a holistic approach to health. And by that I mean he knew his patients very well. He knew what their stress level was. He knew their families. He knew what their spirituality was. He knew who they were exposed to as far as infectious disease. He knew where they worked and different possible exposures they might have had in work environments and how that impacted their lives. So in addition to the Western medicine that he practiced, he knew and practiced the holistic approach and found those to be, again, an integral part of what engenders health in an individual.
Don, you need to know that this old podcaster remembers Marcus Welby, and I'm so old that I don't remember much of it.
Well, just the basics. So you must be old.
Thank you.
Wise though, maybe.
So the martial arts was important to bringing you to where you are now, and I understand that. When you talk about the cultural things, there's such richness to the Native American Indians. And what's the scope of that influence on your practices?
Oh, good question. And actually, when I was talking about the interesting correspondences between the way Eastern cultures look at treatment of disease and the multiple factors that go into it, I had exposure to treatment of Native American individuals in my neuro rehab practice in central Minnesota and did work with them. I did their purification rituals with them and such. And I was really blessed with being kind of taken in and introduced to some of these practices. And when I was studying, more recently, when I was studying Tibetan medicine, and they talk about the elements, the five elements of the world, and how they relate to each other, and how that relates to disease, and how that relates to the body, how that relates to food and the like. And when I was taking a course in it, there was a Native American that was in the audience, and there were Tibetan doctors that were part of the teaching faculty for this particular class. It was at the University of Minnesota, and they were talking about the different elements and how they related to each other and how that kind of was shaped their view of the world and practice of medicine. And they're on opposite ends of the earth, and they had similar ideas with regard to the elements and these holistic principles. And that was kind of a shocker, but it's neat to see that. Native Americans are very into connection with their environment. They're very much into the family. They don't have as much of a written tradition, and that's why it's not as well known as like Chinese medicine and the like, because their written tradition goes back very, very far. But most of the Native American tradition is passed on orally, so unfortunately a lot of it is a little thin now and a lot lost. But they do have a profound respect for a connection with their environment and their people and foods, herbal medicine and the like. And again, herbal medicine is kind of another interesting side story, because that cuts across, you know, the world as far as how people use different plant materials as medicine, and food is medicine. And that's it's another topic that we could talk about for a couple more podcasts.
Doctors will frequently bring in consults, other doctors, to share ideas and ask questions with. That's common. However, have you ever had an opportunity to bridge out to one of these other anthropologies and bring that kind of a specialist in your work?
I did and in fact, in that context of treatment of Native Americans, that some of their cultural practices were part of what we were doing in rehab, and we did absolutely share that therapy arena, for if you want to put it in that way, because they were being treated in a very holistic fashion in the rehab hospital per se, but also had programs in the Native American treatment program as well. So yeah, definitely. And also I should say that in my practice of rehab medicine, I introduced more and more Eastern medicine into the mix. And so I would do group seminars and group therapy sessions with my patients, introducing meditative topics and acupuncture, acupressure, dietary ideas and such, in the context of, like, again, food as medicine. So I would be introducing that even on the Western side, but we'd bring specific cultural contacts. And in my more recent work, and I've done some more recent work in the forensic setting, actually, in individuals that have acquired brain injury issues and unfortunately are in a very bad situation as far as committed for being recognized as being dangerous. And in that setting, there's some individuals from different cultures, Somali culture, for an example, and we bring in individuals and spiritual leaders from those cultures as part of treatment in that setting as well. So I think there's a greater and greater sensitivity to the need for cultural connections with people, not only with regard to the value of those modalities, but also the importance of relationships and family and culture as being part of what engenders health.
This conversation about bringing in other kinds of specialists that are of value, I mean, it reminds me of 20 years ago when the MD was welcoming the chiropractic physician into clinics and hospitals. Now you're trying to bring acupuncture in. Are there other physicians that are trying to blend acupuncture with their standard Western protocols?
Oh, there sure are. It's still not a still not a big percentage of physicians, MD-type physicians, but there's actually a national group, American Academy of Medical Acupuncture, and I'm a member of that organization, a diplomat status. But so it's a, again, an increasingly practiced modality, even with MDs. And it's used, you know, in anesthesiologists use it for pain management. OBGYN doctors use it for any number of other hormonal issues. Different cardiologists use it for stress management. You know, it has effects on a lot of the same disease states that we use medications to treat. So the answer is yes. It's not, you know, it's not mainstream medicine, but it's moving in that direction, and people are recognizing the value of such techniques and the scientific evidence for such techniques. Even things like meditation, people are doing research with how meditation affects brain functioning, and it's just fascinating work. And it's, I think, when that particular awareness, when traditional Western medicine doctors see the scientific value of what's going on with meditation, acupuncture, and other such modalities, they instantly become believers, because it's basically a validation of what mindfulness or the meditation practitioners have been doing.
Do medical schools all share essentially the same curriculum, or are there some that include acupuncture as part of their standard curriculum?
Well, I think, you know, there's a standard, and I think, you know, you can see there's a pretty solid commonality in a lot of the core curriculum across medical schools. But that being said, there's even the most traditional, you know, the highest, you know, esteemed institutions of learning, like Harvard Medical Schools, Stanford, they're all doing more work and more research and more teaching in these areas of integrative medicine. And so, sure, it varies as far as the degree of exposure that a medical student would get. But again, I think, and it's still not a major percentage of what a person is learning. There's still that core set of skills that is taught in a typical medical school, and still emphasizing pharmacology and surgery, which is the cornerstone of Western medicine. But that being said, there it's integrative medicine is creeping in there and being increasingly recognized.
How do you define integrative medicine?
I'll try to be as simple as possible, and just think of it as an eclectic blend of health and wellness practices. And I think when you say, and I think we should be careful when we say medicine, we use the term integrative medicine, because I'd prefer to use the term integrative health and wellness practices. That's more general. And I think that's really telling the story better. So it's both for healing, for treating disease, but also as an excellent preventative strategy, an excellent health strategy. So that's it. It's an eclectic blend of health and wellness practices.
I once heard a phrase which I never understood, and that is the perfect exercise. Does that fit into our conversation at all?
Yeah, it sure does. In fact, I've over the years given lectures and various topics of that, of different meditative exercise modalities. And I could even broaden that to say that you could ask about what's the perfect diet. I could go into that one too. But answering your question, the perfect exercise, I like to use that term. It doesn't do everything for a person. But if you think about a meditative exercise, and we're talking about practices specifically Tai Chi, Qigong, even Pilates, if they're done, yoga, if they're done in the optimal fashion, they are actually addressing very important elements of wellness practice. And three, the perfect exercise, in my view, encompasses a movement, breathing, and meditation. And so that's And again, I think you could cut across different type of exercises, which, and not being picking a favorite necessarily, but I think all of those, the ones I mentioned, like yoga, qigong, tai chi, they, if they're practiced in that way where they emphasize a movement coupled with a very thoughtful breath pattern and are done in a way that they're so focused that you're in the moment, and that's what meditation is, being in the present. If you combine all three of those elements, that's the perfect exercise, in my view. And I think, you know, it really makes sense. And even if you're doing conventional exercise in a exercise club, say, and your trainer is there, if your trainer isn't saying breathe, you're holding your breath, you're not doing an optimal exercise, even though you may be doing a lot of physical work with it. So again, you can even see examples of how this concept of perfect exercise really fits.
I saw a flyer not long ago from a area, I think local area, senior center, and they were describing a new kind of exercise they were promoting, and it seems like this might have been it. And with that in mind, with the assumption that's in fact what they were promoting, I wonder if there's a way to get these larger health practices adopted by communities, villages, towns, cities.
Oh, sure. And there, that brings up an interesting movement. I think it's probably fair to even call it a movement, where people are actually trying to introduce healthy practices into their community. There's this whole series of books that were written by an individual. His name is Dan Buettner. And his initial book is called Blue Zones. And basically, he was searching centurions, people that lived to be 100 years old. And he was interested, he was a scholar for National Geographic, and he was interested in studying why people live to be 100. And so he would go to different parts of the world and see, you know, what type of health habits and practices in general these individuals would have, and see why they lived so long. And so he looked at several cultures, and he found, you know, commonalities as far as their program of movement, how they move throughout the day, that they, and it, again, it's also speaking to integrative life, where you have to look at low stress, spirituality, relationships. Exercise was part of it, though. Diet was part of it. And that those would be our two biggest guesses about what you should try to introduce into a community. But that, when you said, are communities doing it, that's an interesting question, because there actually is a smaller town in Minnesota that's trying to adopt the principles of the Blue Zones, introducing social connections more, healthy habits, herbal teas, good rest, low stress, spirituality as part of a community effort. And so, again, that's a model system in my very own state of Minnesota. And so, interesting that's coming up. As far as in a less comprehensive manner, you can introduce, and I have given seminars on East-West medicine and introduced a Qigong series, and it's easy to learn. In 2 hours or hour and a half, I can kind of give just an introduction to East-West medicine and teach a Qigong form that a person could use for the rest of their life, and it combines those elements, that of a perfect exercise. Not hard to learn, looks neat, and people do it. And so that, I think that's a good way of doing it, and that's just introducing it as a community offering. Can be done in a community setting, community center.
We've touched on a very broad range of very important themes, and I'm hoping we can continue with another interview. However, before we conclude with this one, what is the most important statement or idea that my listeners should consider based on this conversation?
I think the most important concept, and if you think about it, this really ties it all together, that, and I mention it as Eastern definition of health and wellness, and that's balance. And I like to use the word harmony. It sounds a little more poetic, but balance. If a person is in good balance with regard to the amount of exercise they do, they don't have to do too much, too little. The diet, they don't have to do everything perfect, but if they're in a good balance, if they're in a good balance in their stress management, they don't have to be, you know, in a cave, but they could still be dealing with stress, but, you know, just doing things in a well-balanced fashion, because again, that's the definition for health, and I really believe it, and it is part of different modalities that are used. Acupuncture balances energy in the body. Exercise, meditative exercise, balances a person's mental well-being, their serenity, their stress level. So balance, that's in a word.
Don, I have a last question. We were talking about balance, and I remember once, I don't know, maybe it was a YouTube video, but there was something about balance and five elements, and it was intriguing. Can you speak to that?
Sure. And that directly relates to some of the comments that I made about similarities across cultures as far as the way they view life, the way they view their environment, the way they view disease, and in terms of what sounds like metaphors of the elements. And this applies to most Eastern cultures, Ayurvedic, Chinese medicine, and Native American medicine. I think I did mention that too, Tibetan medicine. So let me just explain a little bit about the five elements, and I think you'll see it, see the very elegant relationships that arise when you realize how people put these concepts together. And we'll use the Chinese version of it. And by the way, this is not a formulation that was just thought up by some Chinese person in the middle of the night and couldn't sleep. This is something that evolved over millennia, basically. So these relationships that we see are quite elegant, and they integrate a lot of aspects of life into this formulation. Okay, so I would ask your listeners, Pat, to actually maybe write this down, because then I think you could see the relationships better. So if you just got a piece of paper, made a 5-point star, okay, and I'll tell you what to put on each point. And these are the five elements in the Chinese formulation. And those elements are, start with water for 1 point. Next point, wood. The point after that would be fire. And the point after that is earth. And the last point would be metal. Okay, so again, I'll just say those again so you make sure we got them all right. So you start out with water to wood, and wood to fire, fire to earth, earth to metal, and then metal again to water. And you're going in a circle, basically. And this, okay, and now you can understand how these are elements, they're natural phenomenon, but they were trying to make things orderly. So they looked at relationships between the elements. And we'll start with water, okay? So water grows trees, so that's wood. So water goes to wood. Wood is burned by fire, so that's the next one. And the product of the fire is ashes or earth, so it goes from fire to earth. And then from earth is mined metal, so the next one is metal. And then from metal or mountain springs come water, so you go from metal to water. Now, there, you know, you could argue about, you know, details about, well, the relationships, I don't quite see it, but you can just see a rough relationship there, but it's a really interesting one. But if you really want to be more impressed, and I am, by looking at it a little bit more closely. So if you go from, just start with water again, okay, and then you skip wood, and then you're at fire, right? So if you skip one and you go from water to fire, that water puts out fire. So that's an inhibitory relationship. We demonstrated an excitatory relationship, one thing leading to the next around the circle. But if you skip one, you're actually looking at an inhibitory relationship. Well, what about fire? Just start with the fire one, and then you skip the next one, which is earth, and then you go to metal. So fire melts metal. So that's an inhibitory relationship. It's quite fascinating, quite interesting. And you go from, let's start with metal, and you skip one, you skip the water one, and you go to wood. So metal cuts wood or inhibits wood. So there's an elegant relationship here of the five elements. But this is just the beginning. Okay, so that's fun, and it's interesting, and it's even a little mathematical when you think about N and N plus one relationships, and you can see that in what I just described. But then each one of those elements is associated with other phenomenon, for example, organ systems of the body. And I'll give a couple examples of that too. Okay, so the water element is associated with the kidney bladder system. It seems like a quite direct relationship because of water management in the body, urinary management in the body as part of that water system. And fire, if you think of emotion, the heart, that's a part of the fire system. Earth is more of a nurturing, earthy, sweet system, and that's part of that particular element. And there's even emotions associated with different elements. And I'll try to demonstrate one of those, and quite impressive, I think, as far as emotional connections. And fear is thought to be part of the water system. And when I give a class in this, the hands go up and say, of course, water person is fearful of drowning, so that's part of that system. But even a deeper and more elegant way of looking at fear is to look at the body itself and how it functions and what sits on top of the kidney. And as we know, the adrenal gland is right on top of the kidney anatomically. And the Chinese people didn't know this 2,000 years ago, but over time it rings true. And so what does the adrenal gland have to do with fear? Well, the adrenal gland is the factory of epinephrine in the body. Sympathetic nervous system creates the fear response. It's part of the fear response. So even the neurochemistry of fear fits very well with this formulation, which was established over a long period of time, and it was correspondences that were recognized. Again, not something someone made up overnight, but again, is something that can be understood. So there's the some relationships that you see, and the how did they diagnose that abnormalities in the kidney? We know that the kidney is associated with different issues with management of salt, right? Sodium potassium balance in the body. And so they recognize certain herbal remedies that could treat diseases of the kidney, either a deficiency or an excess, depending on what the person looked like clinically, by recognizing that salt was an important aspect of treatment. And herbs that had a salty taste were associated with different treatments for the kidney system. So again, I'm very much oversimplifying what goes on with the relationships between elements and different parts of the body and the like. But I think a nice illustration. One additional one that was when one of the ways that Chinese doctors in the old days diagnosed kidney systems, they looked at the ears, okay? And I think it'd be pretty hard for me to figure out what that relationship was, although I found out about it later, which blew me away, was that the interesting thing embryologically, when the body develops, when the ear develops, the ear and the kidneys develop at a similar time. And therefore, it's often the case that if there's a congenital abnormality of the kidney, there's also a funny looking ear, congenital malformation of the ear. So they've made that, or they've discovered that relationship, and they used it in their diagnostic formulations of a patient. Another thing about the ear and the kidney is guess how the ear functions, how hearing functions, by a very delicate balance of calcium and different electrolytes in the cochlea, which is part of the ear that registers sound. So that, again, it was recognized by the Chinese doctors that if a person had different deficits with regard to their hearing, they often had issues with their kidney. And in modern medicine, in a renal transplant ward where people have renal failure, kidney failure, across the board, they have hearing difficulties. Why do they have hearing difficulties? Because they have abnormalities in their electrolytes, which are regulated by the kidney. So again, getting a little complicated, but these relationships are just too interesting not to mention. And that exemplifies the balance of the elements, which is the definition, again, of health in Chinese medicine.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting.
I don't know why, when I'm going through the concept of the five elements, I repeatedly think about an old box of, you know, the four, you know, phlegmatic, the choleric, I forget the other two.
Sanguine is one of them, yeah. Yep. And yeah, okay, so, and that's in more on the Western side of theory, and how things worked. Again, a lot of these are replaced by, you know, modern concepts. We don't do cardiac exams by looking at the tongue like you can within Chinese medicine, because that's the orifice that demonstrates cardiovascular issues, like with a very red tongue, fever, da da da, you know, and things like that. We look at more modern techniques, but I think I lost my thread.
Well, I was talking about that, the sanguine, the choleric.
Yeah. Sanguine means someone that's really hyper. And that fits extremely well with the fire element, because that's the fire element is heat, the fire element is fast, the fire element is very emotional. So that's it. It's like person that's supercharged. And so melancholic would fit, you know, better with, well, again, I'm trying to extrapolate, but you can still make some correspondences. Depression is part of the metal element. Can also have some relationship with earth. But so there are different concepts in Western practice. I don't think it is not as well developed, certainly not as developed as what I just described for like Chinese or Ayurvedic medicine, but there's there's some relationships there that are true too. I don't think they ran with it. I don't think they ran with it like the Eastern practitioners. And it wasn't as long of a period of time either, because if you think about it, then Western medicine was being introduced much closer to the concepts of choleric and melancholy and sanguine than the Chinese practitioners and their five elements.
Well, even this much later concepts of the Myers-Briggs, that's more psychological. Well, I guess the melancholy and those features are also. But, you know, these are kinds of concepts that fit really within the five elements.
Well, yeah, it's not a black and white type formulation. I think the relationships run true, but they're not, it's hard to just give one example and say that's true for everybody. It's not, because there's, you know, a person is a combination of various characteristics. In fact, you brought up in my mind another relationship type of formulation that we should mention, and that's in the Ayurvedic and in the Tibetan formulations, because they not only have the elements, but they have what they term three energies. And I'll use and people have probably heard of some of the Ayurvedic ones like Vata, Pitta, and Kapha. And in the Tibetan formulation, it's Lung, Tripa, and Bakken. And so they're called three energies, and they describe a person's personality. And that's what you just asked about as far as Myers-Briggs and how do you do things like that. And we know that people do have certain personality characteristics, right? Even from early development, and some children are just naturally very hyper, and some are very calm and you know, to the earth and don't have as much of the movement. Some are very thoughtful or cerebral, is abstract as far as their thinking, and some are more concrete. And all of those aspects are in the Myers-Briggs, if you know that particular test model. But and you can actually get to analysis of these particular energies in the Tibetan system just by understanding a person's characteristics, their physical characteristics and their behavioral characteristics, how they sleep, whether they sleep a lot, a little, what their even aspects of their energy and whether they prefer hot a lot or cold a lot, all can part you in one of the energies, which correlate with a person's personality. And again, another very interesting way that these Eastern medicine cultures have organized, and it's useful because it drives herbal medicine. It drives what food a person should eat. We didn't even talk about food as medicine, which is basically a variation on the theme of herbs. You know, and that's becoming increasingly important and increasingly known as far as how, you know, food can affect a person's behavior, energy level, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so just to mention, can I mention there was a series, it was I think a PBS series of Confucius as a Foodie, and it's the most fascinating series that I've seen in a while. And basically it was explaining how different cultures utilize food and how important food is in promotion of good health. And one of Confucius's sayings was that food should be your medicine and medicine should be your food. So, you know, it's just, again, a very, very important aspect of that holistic or that integrative concept and the concept of balance.
Very good. Really thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. And I promise that we're going to be back on the air.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd be happy to.
Our guest today, Dr. Donald Starzynski,